Thank you. Here comes my mom. I didn't want to start without my mom. Here she comes. I didn't know I was going to be evaluated. The pressure is on now. Well, thanks. It is such a pleasure to be here. Thank you all so much for coming here tonight. It is such a pleasure to be back in Michigan, even if it is here in Wolverine territory. I am a Spartan, so please bear with me with that. I'm very excited to be here tonight. This is my fourth book, and it's the first book that I've set in Michigan. So this seems like a perfect place to be talking about this. As was mentioned, I was a federal sex crimes prosecutor in Washington, D.C. for 12 years, and I never could leave that job at the office. I thought about it at the office. I thought about it at home. I was taking it home with me every night, and every day I would leave the courthouse and either say to the other prosecutors walking home with me or call up my husband and say, I can't believe what just happened. Somebody needs to put this in a novel. And I think I said that so many times that finally I just dared myself, my husband dared me, we'll do it, let's do it. And so I started writing. Then I wrote about, this may not surprise you, a fictional sex crimes prosecutor in Washington, D.C. Her name's Anna Curtis. And I wrote my first book, Law of Attraction, in the mornings before I went to work at the U.S. Attorney's Office. I turned it in to an agent. She got it sold to Simon & Schuster, and one of the most amazing moments of my life was when Simon & Schuster said to me, we don't think you have one book, we think you have the beginning of a series, and will you please keep writing this series for us? And I had to think about it for about half of a second, and then I said, yes, I will. Because I love books. I've always just loved a great story, the sort of story you can't put down, the sort of story your dinner is burning and you don't notice it because you're so wrapped up in it. So it's really exciting to be on this side of the page. So before we talk anymore, what I'll do is I'll tell you a couple what I think are interesting things about the book. I'm not going to tell you about the story itself too much because I think the great pleasure of a mystery is letting it unfold in front of you. So I don't want to give too much of the plot away. But I'll tell you a few of the interesting kind of real-life things behind the book. I'll read just a tiny bit, and then we can break for some questions. But first, before I get started, what I'd like you to do is, this is my very important memento. I take this around to all my book signings, and I would like you to sign my book. So I'm going to pass this around. Just, you can sign your name, you can write a note. You don't have to write anything brilliant, but just say something. I'll know that you were here, and it really does mean a lot to me. So Kurt, thank you. So as I said, this is the first book that's set in Michigan. The first three books, Anna is home in Washington, D.C. She handles some really tough cases. She has an interesting romantic life. But in all those cases, she was kind of dealing with other people's problems. And in this book, I really wanted it to be much more personal for her. I wanted her to have to go home and deal with her own family's problems, which obviously are always harder for anyone. So she gets a call very early on that her sister Jody has been charged with murdering a man, and not just any man. She's murdered the coach in their hometown, and they have one of these small Midwestern towns that loves their football, and this guy's the football coach at the high school. It's one of those towns like Steubenville, where you have a 10,000-person stadium and 14,000 people living in town, and Friday nights what you do is you go to the football games. So when Jody is accused of murdering the coach, it's kind of like she's being accused of murdering the president there. Anna runs home and she defends her. She goes to the other side of the courtroom to defend her. There were three things about this book that were kind of inspiring real life things that I wanted to talk to you about that are like minor plot points or settings in the book. The first is the rape kit backlog in America. This is a minor plot point in my book, but I wanted to mention it because I love books. I love to get information from books. I like to read a good story and then get to the end and say I learned something in that. And this seems like an important thing to learn. So rape kits are, of course, the swabs that are collected from a sex assault survivor in the immediate aftermath of the assault at a hospital. They're swabs that are taken. They're put in a little box, and then they can be tested for DNA. And they are worth their weight in gold as an evidentiary matter. They're just, you can tell, first of all, that a crime was committed, and second of all, you can tell that someone did it if you find that DNA, or who did it, who's the person, you can identify them. But what has happened is there's, in the last 20 years, this backlog of 400,000 rape kits has grown in America. There are 400,000 of these little boxes sitting in police warehouses all around the country, and some of them are 20 years old. And with the every day, the value of their DNA degrades. It's an issue that some people are starting to talk about, some cities are starting to address. A lot of cities don't even know how many rape kits they have backlogged. There isn't even a catalog of it. Some cities have started to catalog it. Detroit did. Kim Worthy, the amazing prosecutor in Detroit, she kind of stumbled on it herself. She was in this warehouse and was like, what are all these boxes doing here? Realized there are a bunch of rape kits. There were 11,000 in Detroit alone. Each one of them costs about $1,000 to process. They started processing them. They started to get the funds. It's obviously very hard, especially for a city like Detroit, which doesn't have a lot of money to spare. So in the first 1,600 tests that they got tested, guess how many serial rapists they found? 100. 100 serial rapists just from the first 1,600 tests. And these were guys whose DNA we had in police custody in the warehouses, but just was not tested during that time. So you can see how important it is that we get these tested. You can see how it's a problem that we need to be talking about. And you can see also why I wanted it to be in my book. I like to put something in my book that I think is an important thing. So I don't think this gives away too much. It's not that important to the story, but it's important to my heart. So it's in the book. So that's the first sort of real life thing that you will see in the book. The second is the city of Detroit itself. And I find that just such an interesting place right now. It used to be that when I was a little girl, we were told, be careful walking around Detroit, you might get mugged, whatever. Now, so it was a scary place, right, Detroit. Now you go to Detroit and it's kind of a vacant place. It's empty. You walk around and there aren't people there. There aren't even pigeons there, because pigeons need the people, even crumbs and stuff. The overall feeling in some neighborhoods there is just one of emptiness. It used to be called the Paris of the West, right? And now there's so much vacant land that you could fit all of Paris in the vacant land that's in Detroit. So some people love to go there. You've all seen the rune porn that, people love to go take pictures of these incredible buildings, the Opera House, the old train station that are kind of crumbling now, and they really are shocking, incredible pictures. If you Google it up, you'll see some amazing old buildings that are now fallen to ruins. But I think it's more than that. It's more than just the beautiful ruins that are left. It's really a question of, is Detroit a canary in the mineshaft? Is this what all of America needs to fear and worry about in a post-industrial age when we're not manufacturing anymore? And so on the one hand, you have that worry about it reaching bankruptcy, about it being this sort of ghost town. On the other hand, it is this amazing kind of urban experiment that's going on right now, unlike any other city in America. And I think that's so interesting. There are artists, there are urban farmers, guys who are just like, oh, look, all this empty land. Let's put some wheat here. Let's put a bunch of cherry trees here. There are community planners, churches, activists, so much so that now I just read an article recently that says Detroit's the new Brooklyn. If you're an artist, if you're funky, if you're a hipster, go move to Detroit. So there's also this amazing spirit of, hey, we can do anything here. Anything can happen here because, they have reached rock bottom, so we can do anything. So there's this amazing optimism that is in the city of Detroit, and I really wanted to capture that in the book, and I tried to do that in the spirit of Cooper, who the love interest of Anna in this book, who is an urban farmer in Detroit. The final thing that I want to talk about, the real life thing that's in the book, is the issue of wounded warriors who are coming home from Afghanistan and Iraq. Cooper is one of those two. He is a character who lost one leg in Afghanistan. And I was really inspired when I wrote Cooper. He was inspired by this young man who lived in my neighborhood named Jonathan Mullen. Jonathan was dating my babysitter, Gemma. And I would see them walking around together, and he had two prosthetic legs. He came home from Afghanistan after serving there in the army, and he was on patrol there one day, just walking a regular day. He stepped on one of those IEDs and woke up, and two of his legs were gone. He came back to the United States. He had to learn to walk again with the prosthetic legs. He, everywhere he goes, his life is totally different now. But I was really inspired by his courage, by his resilience. He is a photographer now. If you look at the book, A Good Killing, that picture of me that's there, that Jonathan took that picture. And I was inspired by the love that they had between the two of them and how that kind of overcame so many things. So I tried to take that spirit and put it in Cooper. And also just another sort of thing where it's something I think we should talk about, and about these wounded warriors who are coming home and how we treat these young men and women who go and put their lives on the line for us out there. So those are three sort of interesting nonfiction things that are in the book. But what the book is really about, it's two things. One is it's about sisters. It's about the bond between women and resilience in women. And it's about a prosecutor who goes to the other side of the aisle. She becomes a defense attorney for a while. And it's hard for her. I think it would have been hard for me. It's particularly hard for Anna because she has a background that makes her like really want to be a prosecutor. And she's a prosecutor in her heart. Right now I'm wearing my handcuff necklace for anyone. Can see, yes. I go to a lot of writers' conferences now in my new life as a writer. And at the thriller writer conferences, this is a very easy shorthand that says, I'm ex-law enforcement and I write crime novels. Everybody who sees me at the thriller writers' conference knows I'm a crime writer and probably former law enforcement. And because you can't do that at the romance writers' conference. It means 50 shades of something different at the romance writers' conference. So you got to be careful with the handcuffs there. But I wear them at the thriller writers' conference also because that's kind of who I am. My dad, who's here, was a federal prosecutor in Detroit. My husband, Mike, was a federal prosecutor in Baltimore. I was a federal prosecutor for 12 years. I really feel like that's a big part of who I am. If you woke me up in the middle of the night and said, "Who are you?" I might say, "I'm a prosecutor." So that's part of my identity and certainly part of Anna's identity. And so she has a really hard time going home and putting herself in the defense attorney position. There really is, by the way. Is anyone in here law enforcement or ex-law enforcement? Yes, Judge Moiseev is. There really is a DOJ rule, a CFR rule, that says that a prosecutor may defend a family member if they're asked and if they're so inclined. And I have promised, if my sisters are ever charged with murder, that I will defend them. So I understand this is being recorded, so now I'm totally on the record. I'll have to defend them. So what I will do is I'm going to read one chapter, and then we'll open up for questions. I have these pretty little A Good Killing breath mints for after you commit your good killing. I have a few of them. Whoever asks the question, I'll give the commemorative breath mints to. Oh, I have one other funny story apropos of nothing, but I see it in my notes, and that is so the coach is killed in a car accident, or apparently killed in a car accident. And I was wondering how to make that happen. As a writer of these crime novels, I really want to get these details right. And so I didn't know how to do it. I don't know much about cars. I don't even know really how to change my oil. I barely can put the gas in the tank. So I went to an auto body shop near me, and I did the whole sort of song and dance where I was like, "Hi, I'm a former prosecutor. Now I'm a novelist. I'm writing this novel. And this guy kind of gets killed or dies in the car, and I'm wondering, how would the character make that happen? Would she cut the brakes or what?" And the two mechanics kind of looked at each other. They looked at me, and they're like, "We don't know nothing about that." "Good luck, ma'am." And then as I left, I'm pretty sure they were calling the FBI. So I did. There was a very nice man, an MPD, in their major crash unit, and he helped me figure out how someone might do away with someone in a car. So that was good. And I think I have a record with the FBI now. All right. So I'm going to start with chapter one. This is a little bit unique in that for the first time we hear Jody's voice. Jody has been a character in all three of the prior books, but this is the first time we hear something from her point of view. I also should mention that with A Good Killing, it is a standalone. If you haven't read my books before, buy this one. I love this one. It's my favorite so far. It's a standalone. You can just jump right in and read it. And if you like it, go back and read the other three then. All right, so this is Jody's voice. So the first time that we hear from Jody in four books with chapter one. When I was 15, my favorite place in the world was the high jump set up at the school track. The bar provided a simple obstacle with a certain solution. You either cleared it or you didn't. In a world of tangled problems with naughty answers, that was bliss. I guess it all started out in that field the summer before my sophomore year. That's when I fell in love with Owen Fowler. I never could hide how much I wanted that man. That's why everyone immediately thought I murdered him. Watching a TV crime show, and the person who says, "I couldn't have killed him, I loved him," is the one who did it. Nothing fuels hate like love gone wrong. So when the coach went up in flames, people naturally looked to see if I was holding the match. But I swear, I didn't kill him. You don't believe me, Annie. I can see it in your eyes. But I'll tell you everything, exactly how it went down. You probably won't agree with what I did. You definitely would have done things differently. But by the end, I hope you'll at least understand. So 10 years ago, the athletic field was the most beautiful place in Holly Grove. A girl could feel like she was part of something good on that rectangle of perfect grass surrounded by bleachers shining silver in the sun. Come fall, the football players would own the field, and the stands would hold 10,000 screaming fans. But in July, the stadium was empty, and the kids who went to Coach Fowler's sports camp got to use the spongy red track that circled the field. The air smelled of fresh-cut grass, the clean smell of a good workout, and the occasional whiff of Icy Hot. To this day, I still love the smell of Icy Hot. And I love the feel of the high jump itself. That moment at the peak as my back sailed over the bar and I looked straight up at the sky, suspended above the earth, touching nothing but air, for a second at least, I was free. It was my little piece of heaven. You know what I mean, right? You were a pretty good runner yourself. What'd you place in the 200 meter? Eighth in state? But track didn't mean the same to you. You'd found another way out. By the time I turned 15, you'd already accepted that scholarship to U of M. Go Blue. That's the only time you'll ever hear me saying that. That summer, you were just killing time before college, hanging out at the track a lot. You told Mom you went to watch me, but you were really there to flirt with Rob. Don't fuss. You know it's true. He was a hottie. And not just because he'd been starting quarterback that year, king of the town. He was objectively hot. Guess he peaked early. You know why he suddenly got interested your senior year, right? After all those years of not knowing your name? No offense, but you finally grew some boobs. My own chest didn't show signs of catching up anytime soon. The high jump was the one place where my resemblance to a wall was still an advantage. I was aiming to break your school record for high jumping, 6 feet, 1 inch. I thought if I broke it, people would finally start calling me Jody instead of Anna Curtis's little sister. I remember the day I first believed I could do it, July 15, 2004. I was trying to figure out why my jump had stalled. I was doing everything right, but it just wasn't taking. I tried again, stood at my starting place, and sprinted toward the bar. I hit my mark and rounded the turn toward the mat, 5 strides, pivot, jump. I flew backward, arched my spine, kicked my feet up, but something was off. I knew it even before my butt knocked down the pole. As my back hit the mat, I heard the bar clatter to the ground and Rob laughing in the distance. I said, "Fuck." "Watch your language, young lady." Coach Fowler stood next to the mat, which was a surprise. He was the head of the whole camp and mostly stayed with the football team, leaving the lesser athletes to the lesser coaches. The thrill of him noticing me was canceled by the fact that it was when I'd messed up. "Sorry, coach." I jumped off the mat and fetched the pole. We set it on the risers together. He was tan and tall, with an athletic build and that aura of authority. The sun threw golden glints off his golden hair. He must have been 40 at that point, but he was way cuter than the teenage boys he coached. "You're a good jumper," coach said. "You could be great, but you have to really want it. Do you really want it?" I looked over to where you and Rob were sitting. Rob was tugging on the tie of your hoodie. The coach followed my gaze. "Your sister's a good runner," he said. "Fast, determined, scrappy. Jody, you're better." I blinked with surprise. He knew my name. And not many people thought I was better than you at anything. He reached over and pulled my hand away from my cheek. I hadn't even realized I was touching my scar. "It's barely noticeable," he said. He cleared his throat and pointed to my pink chalk mark on the ground. "The problem is your approach. Your mark is too close. You shot up this spring, so your stride is longer. You need room to stretch out those long legs." I tried not to blush at the implication that he'd noticed my legs. Coach took a piece of blue chalk out of his pocket and drew a line on the ground, about 3 feet behind my pink mark. He also moved back my starting mark. "Try that." I trotted to the new starting place, feeling the blue nylon of my team shorts brushing against my glamorously long legs. I looked at the coach's marks and wasn't sure I could do it. I glanced at him and he nodded. You and Rob stopped talking to watch me. I took a deep breath, squinted at the high jump bar, and sprinted toward it.
I reached the coach's mark and counted off my curve, demanding my legs cover as much ground as they could with each stride. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, pivot, go. I jumped and I flew. I knew it was perfect the moment I took off. I felt it in my legs, my hips, my spine. I soared back over that pole with inches to spare. Suspended in the air, I looked at the bright blue sky and the soft white clouds and felt a moment of perfection. I landed on my shoulder blades and let myself somersault backwards. A few runners broke out into applause. You yelled, "Go, Jody!" I jumped on the mat. "Yes! There it is," coach yelled. "Good girl, do that at a meet and we'll be putting your name up in the gym." I bounced to the edge of the mat and coach met me with a high five. Then he held out his hand to help me down. I took it, feeling honored, shy, and electrically happy. His grip was steady and strong. Coach's fingers tightened around mine as I stepped down, then opened to release me. But I didn't want to break the connection. I kept holding onto his hand for a few seconds after he let go. That's it. Chapter one. Oh, your book. Sorry. Don't forget that. Now, before we'll go to some questions, but before we do, I just want to thank a couple of people, my mom and Judy and Barbara, who helped bring cookies and soda for everybody afterwards. Thank you for the delicious food. No one will ever go hungry with Diane Harnish in her house with her. Thank you for always nurturing me, Mom. And my dad and my stepmom are here, Alan and Lori. Thank you so much for coming here. And I just want to make clear that my dad is a super nice guy. And in the books, Anna's dad is not so nice. And my poor dad has come out to every book signing that he's been within like a 100-mile radius to. So I just need everyone to know he's a really nice man. Okay, so I've got some mints here for the first person who has a question. So, anybody have a question?
Can you talk to us a little bit about your writing process?
Yes, my writing process. There are two stages. First is the research stage, and that's the fun and more interactive stage. I go and I read as much as I can. I also meet as many people as I can. After 12 years in law enforcement and with my dad and my husband, we know a lot of cops, we know a lot of federal agents, we know a lot of law enforcement. And so I sit down, I have lunch, and I just say, what happened to you yesterday? What's the craziest thing that happened to you this year? Stories are incredible. The challenge is finding a way to put them into a cohesive story in a novel, but it gives me just incredible, rich source material to work with. After I'm done with the research part, I outline like crazy. I think there are two schools of thoughts for authors. There's the outliners, and that's where I fall. I do a very extensive outline, and then I expand it into about 10 pages where I know what's going to happen in every chapter. The other school of thought are the pantsers, the writers who write by the seat of their pants. And it's a much more organic process. Where it's almost magical, it seems. They just kind of know their characters, and they sit down and let it flow. I haven't tried that yet. I think it would take a little more courage and maybe time, because if I messed up, I have to get these things done in 1 year. So I know my process right now. I'm an outliner. And then what I do is every day I wake up for the first draft is 3 to 4 months. And then the rewriting is even more important than the writing. And that process is another 3 months or so. I write in the morning when I'm fresh. And in the afternoon I do the business side, the marketing. And there's, I didn't realize this when I got into it, but being an author is like running a very small, unglamorous business from your kitchen table. So I do that part, the small business part in the afternoon. That's generally. Sir, in the purple shirt.
For your next book, are you going to stay in Detroit and Michigan?
Ah, yes. Am I going to stay in Detroit for the next book? You're going to make me work for this, right? I'll come back here. Yes. You think you can do it? Let's see a little bit. An action shot. Yes. Well done. Yeah, that's a good question. Simon & Schuster was wondering that, too. They wanted to know. And she is. It's going to be, it's not going to be a real town in Michigan. In this book and in the next book, it's not a real town because you don't want to defame anybody. So I make these fictional towns where it's just fictional actors. But she'll be in a fictional college town in Michigan where the issue is college campus sex assaults. And so that's book number 5. Yeah.
Sorry. Never consider working with collaborators?
Ever consider working with collaborators? I haven't yet. A lot of people are doing that now. The big names like the James Pattersons and the Catherine Coulters are taking on less experienced authors to write with them. What I really just enjoy writing my own stories, and I have so many stories from 12 years of being a prosecutor. I have not yet run out of ideas for that. So no, I haven't. I have not done it yet. But I have to say, each book is kind of a collaboration. My husband reads each one of my books before they go out. He helps edit them. I run it past my mom and my dad and my friends. I ask for as much input as I can get. For me, the fun part is the collaborative part. So to some extent, all the books are a bit of a collaboration. So we have Kurt Anthony Krug here. He is a journalist for many of the of our finest Detroit and Michigan outlets, and is also a thriller writer himself, who I'm sure will be topping the bestseller lists probably next year.
Let's hope so. Thank you for that, Allie. Appreciate it. With your next book, you said it's going to take place on a college campus. What more can you talk about it? And is it anything that goes into, Kiss the Girls territory by Patterson? For those who haven't read the book, Kiss the Girls was about a serial collector who kidnapped women from the Triangle in North Carolina, from that trio of universities, UNC, Duke, and collected them. It was a movie with Morgan Freeman. He played the hero Alex Cross, and Wesley from Princess Bride was in it as well. Is it anything that graphic, or what can you tell me that isn't classified?
It's not that graphic, but it's about, I think it's what we read about in the headlines all the time. There are, in America, 1 in 5 women will be sexually assaulted in her lifetime. That's the statistic. In 80% of those cases, it's not by a stranger lurking in the bushes, it's by an acquaintance. And in my experience as a sex crimes prosecutor, it's not just an acquaintance, it's somebody you often know well. It was somebody who the victim trusted, didn't break in through the windows, she let in through the front door. And to me, that's a scarier monster because you don't know to run away. On college campuses, it's a particularly difficult problem. Most of those sexual assaults that happen in the age range where women are on college campuses. And very often they go to their college to try to get some sort of justice. And historically, the colleges have been extremely bad about responding to that. So it deals with those issues, which are a little less graphic than in the Kiss the Girls that you were talking about. But I think, if I may, more important, I think they're very important that we figure out how to do this when we send our daughters and our sons off to college to figure out how they can all be safe. Yeah, thank you for the question. And the mints, yes. Yes, Lisa from the book club.
Oh, thank you. In most legal thrillers that you read, I think, either attorney is running around doing things that are pretty shady, and you never get the full picture. So I really loved that we kind of got all of the steps along the way, even some of the really boring stuff, which is really interesting. So how close to actually what happens are your stories in terms of what Anna's doing as a prosecutor?
Right. I try to keep them very close because I think that's my strength as a writer. Every writer has a different strength, and I think my strength is that I was there. I was in the trenches. I know what happens. I kind of know how it goes down. So I really try to bring that authenticity to the page. And sometimes I'm not, if I get it wrong, my husband will stop me. He is like, no, this would never happen. And sometimes I have to convince him. We have these long debates. He'll be like, this would never happen. I say, it happened on Tuesday. As long as it happened once in real life, then I'm allowed to do it. So there are these once in a lifetime things. But it has to be that it could actually happen in real life. I like that. I like when I'm in an author's hands who I know does that, and I can trust that what I'm reading has that that ring of truth to it. So I do try to bring that to the page. One of these days, I really want to just be creative. I want to write a book about female pirates, and then I won't have to be authentic. But I think as long as I'm writing about a sex crimes prosecutor, especially Anna, I've got to strive for getting it right. The first thing I have to strive for is just entertaining, right? As a prosecutor, the first thing you strive for is you got to tell the truth. That is, you got to find the truth, you got to tell the truth, you got to do justice, you got to get a predator off the streets. And you only have to be as entertaining as is necessary to keep the jurors from falling asleep, because you do want them to hear the evidence, right? But as a novelist, your first job is to entertain. And then, get it right, make it consistent, put in social issues. But, if you've got a rape kit backlog on page 100 and it's boring, nobody's going to read it. Nobody's going to get there. So you have to first make it interesting. You got to have have something, at least on every page, I think that a reader will say, well, that was interesting, or I must find that out, or that was delightful, and I want more. So on every page, that's my job. Yeah, thank you. Yes, sir, here. These are my last two, so after this, questions are free.
Number two, have you had the same editor through all four books? And if so, has she or he become less critical as each book progresses?
That's a great question. I have had the same editor. Her name is Lauren Spiegel. She bought my first book, and she is the one who continued to buy all of my books. I wouldn't say she's gotten more or less. She's just been very steadfast. She gives great big picture edits, things like, I need to know why this character did this. I need a scene. There's a whole chapter in there that I didn't have. She said, we need the how this happened. I can't tell you what it is without giving it all away. But she said, we need to figure out how this happened. And so I put that scene in there. And she's very, very sharp. She has a great eye for reading the book and knowing what needs to be tweaked in that way. So I feel just really lucky to have worked with her all this time. Very lucky. Yes, sir. Right. I think the biggest one is extending the statute of limitations. So, of course, sex crimes are prosecuted at a local level. So for each locality, for each state, there are different rules. And in some states, you can't prosecute a sex crime after a certain number of years have passed. And some of them are changing that because of the DNA that's coming in now. You can get these DNA hits that are 10, 20 years old. And so some of the laws have expanded that. But I think a lot of the Catholic priest stuff was precluded because of the statutes of limitations. And if it were up to me, I would open that up more so that, because delayed reports are very, very common. You know, if you get mugged, you tend to go to the police right away. If you get raped, very often you don't go. Rape is the most underreported crime in America. 80% of people who are sexually assaulted never report it to the police, never report it to the authorities. And very often the reports are delayed. And so I think an extended statute of limitations would be helpful and would address that phenomenon, which we all know is a very true and real phenomenon now. I saw, out of the corner of my eye, a hand. Yes, ma'am.
I assume you have an agent, and I just wondered how you found that person for the first.
Yes. I do have an agent, a literary agent. When I finished my book, it took me a year to write the first book, and then a year to rewrite it. And then I wanted to know, how do I sell this book? How does this happen? So I'm so embarrassed now, but what I did is I went to the bookstore and got one of those yellow How to Get Your Book Published for Dummies book. That's how many people write novels. There's a whole book to How to Get Your Book Published for Dummies. So I read that. It's about 300 pages, and it boils down to get an agent. But it suggests that you're going to send out 1,000 query letters and get back 999 rejections. So I was prepared to wallpaper my bathroom with the rejections, and I'm very organized, so I had an Excel spreadsheet for all the rejections I was going to get. And I just got very lucky, and first shot out of the box, the very first agent, the person I really wanted the most, took me on, really. Said, this looks great, let's do it, and went from there. So it really felt like winning the lottery to me. Yeah. Thank you. I see.
I already have a mint, but... you mentioned that you try to stay on the other side of the line of real crime because of liability issues and other kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But I'm very interested in something like Truman Capote's In Cold Blood,
right,
where I think that he brought the sensibilities of a novelist to a historical event.
Right.
And it's different than journalistic reportage, mm-hmm, because it is a page-turner,
mm-hmm,
and it is thrilling and it is insightful psychologically and all of that. So how much gray ground is there for those kinds of reality / novelistic crime writing?
Right. Well, for me, I don't, I
don't write about any one case. I try to take the most interesting details from a lot of cases and weave them together in a story that's going to give the reader a sensibility of what it's like to try a lot of these cases, the most interesting things, the hallmarks of these cases, and just kind of weave it together into a fictional case that tells a truth that's louder than any one case would be. I love those stories, too. A true crime story told by a master storyteller who knows how to do the plot and the pacing and how to take this real crime, which very often, it isn't as neat as in a novel. It doesn't tie up as nicely. It isn't as satisfying a story arc as a storyteller as writing your own story would be, but who have that ability to tell that story in a way that grabs you like that. So I think that would be interesting to do one of these days. At the moment, what everyone is interested in is Anna, and that's been great. That's been a real thrill to me that people want to keep hearing about her over, through the years. And so that's been such an honor and such a thrill to know that I have a readership who wants to read about her. I've continued to write as the demand has been out there. So who knows what the future might bring, but for now it's me and Anna.
Do you think that if she actually settled down that you'd lose a certain dramatic tension in the books?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's so hard. In the first book, she kind of found the love of her life. And then it became a series, and goodbye, love of your life, because you can't stick around. I know that some authors do that. I know that some authors have like kind of a happily married couple that just are a crime-fighting couple, and I just didn't take it in that direction. To me, some of the most interesting stuff is the falling in love. Is at least as a narrator, it's that delicious tension, and that makes such a fun story. As a woman, I just celebrated my 13th wedding anniversary, and I like just like nice married simple life, But as a writer, it's that falling in love is so delicious. So it's hard to balance out that tension, and I don't know if Anna will ever be able to have true love in her life because of that. I'm just going to have to keep giving her this heartache, poor thing. But it's all for greater good, Mom.
Pure frivolity. But there was an interesting question last night as to why Anna graduated from UK.
Yeah.
And you being a Spartan.
Yes.
Might want to share, especially since we're in Ann Arbor.
Yes, we are. Yes.
Why she graduated from
UVM. Sure. Well, two parts of that. Why did Anna graduate from U of M? I went to MSU. First of all, I'm not Anna. I am not Anna. And I actually wish, now that this is like this big series, I really wish that I had made that more clear at the beginning. But all right, we are where we are. So why didn't she go to MSU? And really, it's just a matter of convenience. So I've found that so much of the writing comes down to these little practical things. And I'll start with the story of the cat, and then I'll get to why Anna's at U of M. So I had Anna have a cat in her first book, and it was going to be a calico cat, because I like calico cats, right? But calico cats, does anyone know this? What are calico cats always, men or women, male or female? They're always female, right? And then in the scenes where Anna's with her cat, I would say, she did this, she did that, and it was confusing whether I was talking about Anna or the cat. So I made the cat not a calico. The cat is an orange tabby, so I could say she, he, and we knew very quickly, shorthand, I'm talking about Anna or I'm talking about the cat. It's got nothing, it's not literary, it's just a way to make it easy for the reader and a way to tell a story where I just want the pages to fly, and I don't want you thinking, is she talking about the darn cat or not? with this one, it was a different sort of convenience, and that is that Cooper, in this book, Cooper, her love interest, is this, in the first three books, I never kind of talked about where Anna went to school. She's from Michigan. She went to Harvard Law School. What undergrad did she go to? It's never been revealed, so it wasn't set in stone. In this book, I really wanted the character of Cooper to be this urban farmer. He grew up on a farm, and then he became an urban farmer in Detroit. And he's this awesome guy. All the ladies who've read it have a crush on Cooper, so I love that. I have a crush on him too. But he had to be a great farmer. He had to be like the world's best farmer. And where do you go if you're going to be the world's best farmer? Where do you go to school? Yeah, you go to Michigan State, of course. So Cooper went to Michigan State, but then I didn't feel like I could have Anna go to Michigan State because they have so much sexual tension with each other that if they went to Michigan State with each other, they totally would have hooked up their sophomore year. She had to go to a different college, so I had her go to U of M so that she and Cooper were in different places, and there's a reason why they didn't hook up in their college years. That's why, that's a long story for why Anna went to U of M. Thanks, Mom. The sex crimes and domestic violence? Not necessarily. I worked in the domestic violence center at Michigan State, and I did help some of the people there. But mostly I wanted to be a prosecutor, I think, because my dad was a prosecutor. And he would come home with these amazing stories, and he was very proud of the work that he was doing. And I loved those dinner table conversations and was very inspired by my dad. Loved my dad a lot. And I think I naturally wanted to go and be a prosecutor and do that. And then once I was at the prosecutor's office, there's the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C., there's two tracks. You can do the guns and drugs, and then you work your way up in severity up until you get to the homicides. Or you can go and do the sex crimes, domestic violence, and you end up trying felony one sex crimes, the most serious sex crimes. And it was fascinating to me. The prosecutors can choose, and you don't necessarily get what your first choice is, but everybody can say what their choice is, and the office tries to put you where you want to go. And all the men went to homicide, and all the women went to sex crimes. Yeah, so much so that they called it the pink collar unit. We have one more question from my dad.
Yes. Do you sometimes just say, I don't like that chapter, two or three chapters, and rip it up and start over again? Or is it really a matter of editing and rewriting it
right.
and tweaking it? Or
right.
is it sometimes just throw it all out and have a whole new section?
Right, it's a question about editing, and this is actually a very frustrating part about being a writer. About half of what I write never makes it to the page. I write it, and I have a document that's my work in progress. Right, the one that I just finished was called Book 5. That's very creative. And then I had a document called Book 5, False Starts. And I take the stuff that I write it, and then I don't like it, and I put it in False Starts. And by the end, False Starts is just as long as Book 5. And that is for you, dear reader, because you don't want to read what's in False Starts. I want you to read the best stuff. But it is, I mean, I guess baseball players, and they have a batting average of, if they're batting 500, that's good. But, in any other job, if, like, you had to throw away half of what you were making, you would feel like you're not making it very well. But I do feel like the rewriting part is just as important as the writing, and that's really where a lot of the magic takes place is when you go back. And so you take stuff out, you edit it, you try to, a lot of times what I find is what I've written in a paragraph, I can say in a sentence. And that makes it much more powerful. If you read a paragraph full of sentences that themselves used to be paragraphs, you get a lot out of that paragraph, and it's more intense. So that's I go over it and over it again. Yeah. Yes, Kurt.
Piggybacking on your dad's question, do you find yourself okay in your false starts, strip mining details and tweaking it so it fits a certain section as well?
In false starts? Now, once it's in false starts, goodbye. Goodbye to you. It's gone. Sometimes what I find is that I do need a scene again, or I need a description, and so I'll go and search for it in false starts. And it isn't all for naught. Sometimes something will be recovered from false starts. But I don't ever read false starts again. It just lives there. And sometimes I say, I know I wrote some interesting sentence. I took it out because that chapter's gone. Let me see. I remember that the word noodle is in there. I do a search for noodle. I find the sentence, and it might be resurrected. So, yeah. Yes.
So you're not prosecuting anymore, right?
I'm not prosecuting anymore since 2011. I'm just writing. I did the quitting of the day job. And that was hard because I really did love being a prosecutor. But for a little while I tried to do all three. I tried to prosecute and be a mommy and be a writer. And I very distinctly remember this one time when I was trying to do it all. I had my two kids in this massive double stroller, one of the, you know, those things that are like so hard to get going, you know, and they're kind of crying and whining, and I'm heading them towards the City Hall because I was setting a scene at City Hall, and I'd like to visit the places that I'm going to see. So I was like, okay, this would be a good sort of day off thing. I'll bring my kids to City Hall, I'll see the scene, and I'll do it all, you know. And then while I'm doing that, I get a call from a cop who says, we've got this evidence we have this evidence in a cooler, but no ice. What do I do with it? I'm like, get it on ice. And I'm trying to get the ice in the cooler to her, and the kids are crying, and City Hall security guard's like, ma'am, you're going to have to move the cart. And I realized, okay, I cannot do all this at once. This cannot all be done at once. I was doing all three at the same time. And so very reluctantly, I gave up the job. But it really is a dream come true to be able to write and be part of this world that I've loved kind of from the other side of the book for so long. So it really it wasn't really even a choice at that point. I had to do it. And I would like to, I think we're probably at the end. It seems like we've run out of questions, but I'd like to really thank Aunt Agatha's for having me here. It is so great to have a wonderful mystery bookshop that brings together a community of readers and really is such a great benefit to Ann Arbor. So thank you. Let's have a round of applause for Aunt Agatha's. Thank you, and I want to thank you guys. Thank you so much for coming out tonight, especially some of you who came from quite a distance, and even if you didn't come from a distance, thank you for spending your night here with me. It really does my heart good. So thank you very much. We have some books here from the bookstore. I'm very happy to sign if anyone's interested.